This is Near FM.
Weekday mornings from 11.
This is Northside Today.
Joining me on the phone now is Director of Friends of the Earth, Oisín Coughlan. Good morning, Oisín. How are you?
Good morning, Mark. Good to be with you.
Oisín, thanks a lot for joining us this morning. Oisín, if you don't mind, before we get into the relevance of the climate conference and then the Kenny speech and specifically Ireland's role and what's happening over there, I know you were in Paris. Maybe you could give us an overall picture of what's happening at the climate conference last week.
Sure. So this is a two-week conference of 196 countries from around the world, or pretty much every country in the world, to try to agree a new global climate agreement on how we tackle the pollution that's causing climate change. So in the past, there have been deals involving lots of countries, but the only countries that had actual targets from that were a small number of countries under the Kyoto Protocol. When I say small, the northern countries, apart from the US, who opted out. So yeah. The EU, Canada, Australia, Japan, etc., those countries have had targets under an international agreement before. But this is an attempt to get all countries on board, from the US and China to India and Brazil and South Africa, as well as the established rich countries in the Northern Hemisphere. And last week we had the grand opening with 150 heads of government there among the largest ever gathering of world leaders under one roof on one day. And then during the week we had civil servants working on a draft agreement, and now they have a very rough draft, and ministers from around the world are arriving. So today, maybe last night, Alan Kelly and Alex White arrived from Ireland, so the energy and environment ministers, and they will be there for, Alan Kelly will be there for the whole week, and the challenge is to try to sign off on a global deal by Friday evening. That's the plan.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Kyoto, and as you say, they tried that a few years back, and it was all a blaze of glory and a blaze of publicity, and we're going to tackle this thing head on, but nothing really happened. Do you get a sense in Paris last week that, you know, there's a bigger commitment now and these leaders are determined? Because we've seen a lot of lovely speeches from all these heads of state, but, you know, was there a little sense of where we've heard all this before?
Well, I think there is more hope for action this time, albeit we still haven't got enough action promised. But it's worth saying that Kyoto wasn't entirely a failure. I mean, the European Union, which is one of the key architects of the Kyoto Agreement, did indeed reduce its emissions and meet its Kyoto target by 2012. Mm-hmm. I think the main problem was the US government changed, Bill Clinton's term ended, and one of the very first things that George W. Bush did when he came into office was declare that he would not ratify and not implement Kyoto. And that was a real problem, obviously, because at the time they were the largest polluter in the world. So Kyoto didn't have as much of an impact as it was supposed to. But it did slow down emissions, and the European Union did do its part. And if you look at the EU now, in fact, its promise for 2020 is to reduce emissions by 20%, and actually it looks like the EU is going to manage to reduce its emissions by 30%. So the EU is making progress,
yeah.
And it's promising to do at least 40% by 2030. What's important in Paris is that they get action from all the other countries. And the biggest thing that has changed in the 10 years since Kyoto came into effect is that we now have the US and China on board. In the last year, both the US and China together have made two deals on how they're going to tackle their emissions. And that means coming into these talks, we have a much stronger basis for an agreement. There's still challenges. India is still concerned about the overall equity of the deal, because supposedly, right back to the Rio Earth Summit in 92, it's the rich countries who are supposed to move first and cut first, and overall that hasn't happened adequately. So India is kind of reluctant to sign up to do big cuts itself when it feels the rich countries haven't kept their end of the deal. But we hope ministers will forge a deal this week. We know for certain one thing already. The deal they do this week won't be strong enough.
Yeah.
It won't promise enough action, but I think it will promote action, and then it'll be down to each of us in our own countries to pressure our own governments to actually act and to do more than they've put on the table so far, and to actually do enough to contain climate change.
Yeah, well, that kind of brings me on nicely to and the Kenny went, and he, like all the leaders, he spoke at the conference last week, and yourselves are friends of the earth. You're a little bit disappointed in what he had to say.
Well, we were disappointed with his double speak, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
He spoke, he gave a grand old speech in the plenary hall with, to all the world leaders. But then he came and talked to the Irish media and said, basically said, listen, lads, don't worry, I didn't mean it to the audience back home. Because in the plenary hall, he said, we better be serious, and we want a legally binding deal on climate change around the world, and we want to contain climate change will require action from all countries, big and small, and Ireland is determined to play its part. And then he came out and said to the journalists, Ireland's targets are unfair, they're too hard, mm-hmm. we've lost a decade because of the recession, and we need time and space to be allowed to get our house in order. Basically, we aren't rich enough yet to be able to cut our emissions, and farming is very special for us here, so we need kind of a get-out clause for farming. Now, that's just wrong on a number of levels. First of all, the recession makes it easier to meet our 2020 targets because the recession reduced our emissions,
mm-hmm.
So we have some of the work's been done for us by economic recession. The problem is the government hasn't put in place plans otherwise, in the absence of a recession, to contain and cut our emissions. And secondly, no one's asking Ireland to do more than its fair share. No one's saying that agriculture in particular has to do anything before 2020. We have lots of things we can do in transport, in energy, in housing, and retrofitting and making warmer homes. And that's where the big focus should be for action. For the last 5 years, there hasn't been enough of it, and for the next 5 years. And yes, agriculture will have to also make efforts and make sure it's as efficient as possible, and ultimately it will have to probably cut emissions. What it can't do, and this is why there's trouble, mm-hmm. is we can't decide that the engine of the Irish economy for the next 30 years is going to be making more baby milk powder and persuading another million Chinese mothers to stop breastfeeding and start taking baby milk powder. Ireland makes 20% of the world's baby milk powder, and we want to expand. That's not feeding the world. Yeah. That's not a sustainable industry. And the other issue is beef. We can't, doing beef in Ireland doesn't actually make money, so we can't plan for the massive expansion of the massive retention of beef farming while also expanding dairy, and just say we should be let off the hook in agriculture because we're feeding the world. Well, we're not feeding the world. The Minister of Agriculture's own words are we're making premium products for premium markets.
Yeah.
So if the European Commission lets us off the hook, well, next in line will be German car makers saying, well, we make the most carbon efficient, that'll be more difficult to say after Volkswagen, but the most carbon efficient luxury cars, and every Chinese millionaire has a right to a luxury car, just as every Chinese mother has a right to Irish baby milk powder. It's not going to wash. And so Ireland will have to do its fair share. And the government is gambling a lot of Irish taxpayers' money in the hope that we'll get a soft deal from the European Union. And I don't think they will. I think the Commission and I think other European countries won't want to give Ireland a soft deal, won't want to reward Irish inaction on all the other areas that, over the last 5 years. And if we don't get a soft deal, we are facing fines for missing our targets of mm-hmm. €2 billion or more every year for the decade from 2020 onwards. So I think Ireland's gone about this the wrong way. We should have been pushing for action as a government in Ireland on all the other sectors, and then saying, look, we need some sort of allowance for agriculture, and then we might have had a strong hand.
Yeah.
But because we haven't done enough in any sector, the European Union isn't inclined to give us a special pass for one sector.
Is that, as you say, Oisin, is that ultimately what the problem is with all these climate conferences and all these attempts to tackle climate change and global warming? Is on the one hand, you have industry and business that is driven by profit, wants to make as much profit as possible. And on the other hand, you've got the need and the dire need. I mean, we only seen it here over the last 3 or 4 days here, the weather. You don't have to be a genius to know that climate change is something tangible. You just have to look out your window sometimes. But is this ultimately what it comes down to? And I mean, we've got the conference in Paris this week, and as you say, hopefully something will come over, but it won't be enough. And is this ultimately the either-or situation that we keep coming back to? It's big business versus to make the right decisions against climate change. The two of them just don't sit well together.
Well, it's not all business, I should say, but it is worth remembering that the fossil fuel industry is the richest, most powerful industry the world has ever seen. And a bit like the tobacco industry, when it came to the regulation of tobacco and the promotion of public health around smoking, they are fighting tooth and nail, and they're buying politicians, and they're buying officials, and they're buying lots of lobbyists, and they're pushing really hard to minimise the efforts to regulate fossil fuels. It's up to the rest of us to provide a counterbalance in terms of power and put more pressure on our politicians to act. So, I mean, we are up against it in facing the fossil fuel industry. But it's not all business. So, for example, last week in Ireland, through Business in the Community, which is a kind of a charity that helps business to help local communities and so on, they came out, like a group of businesses who work with them, came out with a statement calling for strong international action and strong action in Ireland too. And there are business opportunities as well in the transition to a low-carbon economy. So just over a year ago, a group of kind of mostly multinationals like Diageo and Vodafone, but actually also Bord Gáis and Bord na Mona, came out, they commissioned a piece of research and they came out with a report showing all the areas where Ireland could have business opportunities and create jobs with smart grids and electric cars and smarter agriculture and renewable energy and retrofitting, where we could be making money and creating jobs as we reduce pollution. And for example, one issue that we're focused on a lot at the moment is solar power. Mm-hmm. So in Ireland, you wouldn't have thought so over the weekend, but actually Ireland has quite a high potential for solar energy, solar electricity, and because the costs are falling and because we have long daylight hours. So, you know, UK, Denmark and Germany, which have similar weather to us in the northern parts, have lots of solar energy and are growing it. Mm-hmm. We have hardly any because there's no price at all on it. So if you put up a solar panel on your roof, you can boil your kettle or run your dishwasher. But after that, you just have to give away the electricity to the national grid and to the ESB. We want a price from government, not a big subsidy, just a price. Mm-hmm. So that if there was a price, well, then you could really unleash a rooftop revolution. You could have every green school, every JA club, every soccer stadium, every barn in the countryside, if you wanted to, and every parish hall could become a community-owned power plant. And you could really get people involved, not just in acting, but in investing and in owning and in getting money from the transition to a low-carbon economy. And that's the sort of innovation and involvement we need of local people to get everybody feeling involved in the transition we need.
Yeah, because, I mean, you say about solar energy I mean, again, we would have seen, especially over the weekend, Ireland is uniquely placed in the world where we could harness an awful lot of wind energy. But every time we talk about putting up wind farms, there seems to be somebody who's objecting to it on whatever grounds. And I mean, I'm sure they're all valid grounds, but I mean, do we need a change in our thinking? Is that ultimately what we need to do? We need to get people to just think differently about this stuff.
We do need to... help people think about the big picture, and I mean, and to be honest, there's been very, very little leadership from the government, particularly over the last 5 years, and they have been busy, obviously, with the recession, in helping frame the choices and discuss the choices with people, because, of course, it's not a question of wind or no wind, it's wind or solar, maybe, or some anaerobic digestion, so that's like kind of large-scale composting, industrial kind of composting, there's those things, or else we could have fracking. Mm-hmm. Or we could just keep burning coal in Money Point, or we could keep burning peat in the Midlands and face fines for doing that and destroy our bogs even more. Or we could go nuclear, which I don't think would be very popular either.
No.
But, you know, they're the actual choices we face. It's not wind or no wind. And when you come to think about wind, just briefly, I mean, we got from zero wind, basically, in the system about 10 years ago or 15 years ago, to 20% of our electricity coming from wind, without much public opposition, to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't mind wind farms being, you know, in the countryside or whatever. And some of us, I think they're quite beautiful a lot of the time. And then two things happened. One is we needed to upgrade the electricity grid, not just for renewables, but yes, partly for renewables. And that involves pylons. And pretty much everyone agrees pylons are ugly.
Yeah.
And people are worried about the health impacts, although they're not. It's not proved that there are health impacts, but people don't like them. And at the same time, there was this plan to export lots of wind from the Midlands to to Britain. And those two things got confused or like put together by everybody, and that really sparked off local opposition that I don't think anybody was anyone was prepared for. And to be fair, some of the big companies going into the Midlands did not operate in a very, you know, transparent or diplomatic way. In they just did deals with lots of people, and people got felt left out, and people felt their communities were being imposed upon. So it wasn't handled very well. And we would rather see a system like you have in Denmark, where when a developer is developing a wind farm, they have to offer 20% of the equity, 20% of the ownership, the shares in it, to local communities at cost price. And so therefore local communities get free electricity, probably, and if those shares aren't sold, well, then they can't go ahead. Now, there's the thing, like, you can sell them within 5 kilometres, within 10 kilometres. So it gives communities not quite a veto, but it means communities have to be involved, and not just in getting a few bob thrown off like a charity for the GAA club to buy new jerseys, but actual ownership. And all the evidence suggests that if you were concerned about a wind farm and you felt like you were hard done by in how it's put up, well, then you'll see it and you'll be anxious and you'll feel it's having a negative impact on you. If you were involved in the ownership of the wind farm, and you look at as it was being planned, and you look out your window and you see it spinning 500 metres away, you don't feel anxious. Every time it goes when you go there, you feel better off, literally better off, metaphorically better off. So a lot of how people feel about wind farms comes down to how they feel about the process that put them there, and how they feel about the ownership of the wind farms. And if it's a local farmer who did a backhand deal with the developer, or if it's a big company that came in and did it, they'll feel one way. I should say local landowner, isn't always a farmer. Mm-hmm. But if it was a community effort and they have an ownership of it, they'll feel great about it. And it's as simple as that. We need a much more collective, or at least a much more involved ownership of the wind technology, and then people will be okay with it.
Yeah. Oh, Oisin, before I let you go, there's just one thing I wanted to ask you. As you say, the Minister for the Environment and that are over in Paris now this week, and they will come back with a deal of sorts, as you say. You know, we head into an election next year. Do you expect to see all the major parties have, be serious about tackling this issue in their programmes for government going forward before the election, or do you think it's something that might just drop back down the pecking order with other things on the table?
Well, of course, elections often boil down principally to tax and spending, and obviously there's big issues in healthcare and everywhere else. But I actually am hopeful that these issues won't drop off the agenda. I mean, I think it'll be good that the climate change law is passed here, and that the Paris, which happened last week, which we've worked on for about 8 years, and hopefully some sort of deal in Paris, because both of those things are actually just kind of the framework. You know, they're the policy-making framework. And then we can turn our minds to the actual concrete things. And I think that's much easier for people to get their heads around, and some of them have become issues already. So fracking, for example, will be an election issue in Leitrim and around there, and it should be an issue for all of us, because it could be all our ground water that gets polluted by that. And wind energy is going to be an election issue in some places, but I want to see whether what we do about the feed stations, and what we do about Money Point, and what we do about solar energy, and what we do about retrofitting our homes and support for that. They are concrete issues that it's actually easy enough for people to get their heads around. They're much more tangible, much more real than abstract numbers of degrees and abstract clause 4 of some law. So I hope those issues, people might even think about them as climate change issues, but basically they're energy issues and pollution issues. And I think they will be on the agenda. If not, they'll certainly be in the manifestos. And if I had any plea for people, it would be when politicians call to your door in the next few months, just do say, listen, I'm concerned about climate change. What are you going to do about fracking? Or what are you going to do about helping me insulate my house to have a warmer home? Make it concrete for them. But just do say, I'm concerned about climate change, and then go on to the concrete stuff. And if enough of us even just say that, when we start talking to politicians again after the election, they won't say to us, as they like to say to us often, I'm sure it's important, but nobody mentions it on the doorstep. So let's mention it on the doorstep, and then let's get on with action to make our homes warmer, our transport faster and more public, and keep fossil fuels in the ground.
Absolutely. Listen, Oisin, it's been great talking to you this morning, as always, and thanks for bringing us up to date, on what's happening in Paris, and, Ireland's role, and what the future might hold in the coming years for us if we're really committed to tackling climate change. It's been great talking to you, Oisin. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark. Good talk to you.
Cheers. Thanks a lot. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
This is Near FM.
Weekday mornings from 11.
This is Northside Today.